When Stravinsky and Nijinsky's ballet, The Rite of Spring, had its notorious premiere on May 29th in the year 1913, audiences acted as if it had come from nowhere. They howled at the stomping, angular choreography and the pulsing, unsettling rhythms and dissonances in the music. By now, we have multiple movie recreations, along with the memoirs and PhD dissertations that have told us over the years that this was a modernist landmark. Modernism tended to play with pieces of things, fragments.
It starts to undermine the meaning, your sense of where anything would go or to what it belongs.
The sense of not knowing where anything would go or to what it belongs didn't begin in 1913, but it came to a head in that year. The Rite of Spring in the Spring in Paris. Then add the Armory Show in New York in February 1913. Audiences scandalized by unrecognizable fragmented images unlike any they had ever seen.
This was, for the American art public, a shocking event.
The Futurists in Italy, creating synthesized music based on the noise of newly invented machinery.
This made him certain that he was expressing something, being struggling.
The poets exploring words for their own sake.
The words become their own thing, their own entity.
Well, one's hearing this one telling about being one being living. We're hearing this one telling.
In March, Arnold Schoenberg is forced off the stage in Vienna by an angry audience not willing to accept his atonal music. And what becomes clear is that it is not a coincidence what happened in this year.
It was a confluence.
In the 20 years before, things had changed with such speed it was incomprehensible.
For the people then, when you read their diaries, their letters, and they say, everything's changing so fast, everything is accelerating so fast, I've got the feeling that I'm on a fast train and I don't know how the points are set. We don't know how this will end up.
1913 was a year when the response to all this change broke out. And there are those who say it was right around this time that the 20th century officially began.
I think in a lot of ways it was just the beginning of a century of absolute chaos and nightmare, and as so often, the artists heard it and reflected it first.
For the next hour, Culture Shock 1913. I'm Sarah Fischko. Shock is good, said artist Marcel Duchamp. He ought to know, he who sent shockwaves through the art world several times, first with his painting Nude Descending a Staircase No. 2, the star of the Armory Show in 1913.
Well, even while you were working in the Cubist style, you nonetheless managed to produce a Cubist painting, the Nude Descending a Staircase, which shocked the Cubists.
Yes.
Why did it shock them so much?
When I came with my Nude Descending a Staircase, they didn't see that it applied to their theory.
In Paris, and later in New York, the abstracted image and the irreverent title of Duchamp's famous painting scandalized all who saw it.
So they thought it was too much, neither one, nor futurist, nor cubism, and they condemned it.
Condemned in Paris, reviled in New York, which is where our story begins. Democrat Woodrow Wilson was just about to take office as the 28th president. Silent movies were all the rage, and Enrico Caruso was a major star, having become a fixture at the Met and sold millions of records since 1904. Up and down the city, billboards and posters announced the upcoming opening in February of a major art show at the 25th Street and Lexington Avenue Armory, presenting the latest in European art.
Dr. Brown, the Armory at Lexington and 25th Street is a...
Author and art historian Milton Brown spoke about it on the Armory Show's 50th anniversary for the radio program Observation Point.
The Armory Show was actually a break in the development of American art. It was probably the most important exhibition that was ever held in this country, and as an art exhibition, probably had the greatest effect that any ever had. It was the introduction of modern art to America.
The introduction of modern art to America. Just think of it.
What was happening in our art world in 1913? Were we completely conservative or orthodox in our tastes in art?
I think that was the trouble. Nothing was happening. American art was dominated by academic standards and what was called the academy. There were many academies in the country. They tended to dominate aesthetic standards as well as exhibition facilities, and there was very little opportunity for young, unknown, or progressive artists who were not academic to show.
The interesting thing about the Armory Show is that it was organized not by entrepreneurs, professional art exhibitors, or event producers. It was organized by artists who were fed up with the tyranny of the academy. So they formed an artists' association, and in 1912, three of them, Walt Kuhn, Arthur B. Davies, and Walter Puck, took the long 10-day journey by boat to Paris to find examples of the art revolution taking place in Europe. In Paris, where Debussy was writing adventurous piano preludes, the Americans encountered young painters like Picasso and Braque, who had started to break apart images in the most dramatic way, altering reality, dividing canvases into fragments and piecing them together. By 1913, others from Italy and Russia had joined them in this. It was a complete departure from the art of conventional portraits and sedate landscapes.
What Picasso and Braque were trying to do was invent a new language of painting.
Museum of Modern Art chief curator Anne Temkin.
So that a shoulder didn't look like a shoulder. A shoulder looked like a group of lines that intersected, not because they needed to show people what a shoulder was, but because of the intersection of that group of lines made for an interesting looking structure on a canvas. So the priority was shifted completely away from being true to what you would see, for example, in a photograph, and instead emphasizing that what was on the canvas was an interesting thing to look at, even if it didn't look like anything that you could identify.
Photography had more or less made this demand of painters. Neuropsychiatrist and Nobel laureate Dr. Eric Kandel reminds us. Artists had to find something else to do once they didn't have to represent reality.
So that led art into two directions. One is to emphasize expression, emotion, much more than photography could. And the other is to abandon form, beginning with Cézanne, and then moving on to Cubism, and then ultimately to abstract art.
The American painters abroad visited artists who led them to other artists. They went to galleries and studios and found hundreds of the most interesting works to bring back to America in crates on another long boat ride. How they managed to engineer all this, it is hard to imagine.
And so they felt that if they could get together and do a mammoth exhibition, they could really wake America up.
And how many paintings were in this exhibition in 1913?
We can't be exact about it, but approximately 1,300.
1,300 European and American artworks.
I'm here to see Captain Gendron.
For $5,000, the artist organizers rented not a gallery, not a space intended for art.
The door on the left?
But the 69th Regiment Armory, which had just been built a few years before. Giant space.
Okay.
The building takes up a little more than an acre, 62,235 square feet.
Welcome. Thank you.
First time here?
The Armory at 25th Street in Lexington still hangs a reproduction of Nude Descending a Staircase in a special display window devoted to this chapter in its cultural history.
But I believe it came out from this wall here.
The artists liked the fact that the Armory wasn't a museum or a gallery. They wanted a big open space where they could pack people in.
The art show of 1913, that's the space as it looked in 1906. The drill floor is a total of 26,000 square feet, so I can actually...
The association built multiple octagonal walls to divide the giant area into room-like spaces devoted to various artists and styles. The show featured many American paintings of different kinds, and in one area, which became known as the Chamber of Horrors, were Cubist paintings by Picasso, Braque, Leger, and several works of Marcel Duchamp, including the notorious Nude Descending a Staircase No. 2. That painting, above all others, with a dark background with angular flesh-colored shapes, defined by black, mostly vertical lines, with vague allusions to a human body moving downward diagonally, created a mass uproar. Art historian Kimberly Orcutt reminds us.
A lot of the complaints of Duchamp's nude really, in the end, take the form of the question, where's the nude? They want to be able to immediately discern the nude, and this idea that a painting would purposefully not express what the title is was considered kind of a breach.
It came across as a break in the kind of unspoken contract between artist and viewer, which had been pretty straightforward up to this point. A title and a subject that could be clearly comprehended. With the cubists and abstract painters, all bets were off. Author Alec Neval Ali.
A newspaper offered a prize to the first person who could spot the nude in that painting.
And there was that title, which itself violated well-established principles about what a nude in a painting was permitted to do.
Nudes were allowed to recline, they were allowed to stand, but the idea of a nude getting up and going downstairs, I think, is what upset people more than anything else.
And the artist had tried to compress the nude's whole walk down the staircase into one image.
Duchamp's great angle in making the picture is putting her in motion. So doing something that's photographic, not even photographic, filmic, with something on a canvas.
Filmic had real meaning at that time. Film was an emerging form of art and even more entertainment. Right then, in 1913, D.W. Griffith had just finished making 450 short films over the last 5 years, during a period when brand new notions of movement, storytelling, and editing were being born. Tom Gunning is a film historian and a Griffith scholar.
What Griffith does do is begin to think about how can you tell stories without dialogue, with a minimum of words. There are a few very brief uses of intertitles. And editing becomes his tool, which is to say, you know, articulating the film into fragments. And those fragments are fragments of space and time.
Before this moment, filmmakers would set up a camera, say 10 or 12 feet away from their subjects, and shoot. What Griffith and a few of his contemporaries began to create was the modern language of film. They realized they could vary the impact of an image by shooting close-ups, by cutting the length of shots, and by cross-cutting from one scene to another.
So that you're telling a story by the way that you control viewpoint and detail and emphasis.
Film, which was able to distort time and create its own shocking images, had a growing popular audience, as well as an audience of artists.
So this image of a kind of modern, unstable, crazy world, surrealism before surrealism is invented, is there in the cinema. And definitely Picasso, Braque, all these people are crazy about the movies.
And it's hard not to conclude that these fragments of a story being pieced together to make a film, this radical way of seeing images, found its way into visual art, paintings. It's hard not to associate this to ideas about relativity, as Einstein's theories about time and space had just emerged too, between 1905 and 1911. The Armory Show was everything it was intended to be and more. It was eventually seen by 500,000 people. Former President Teddy Roosevelt turned up at the show, and in an op-ed piece, he called the artists who were creating modern work extremists, and he alluded to Duchamp's painting by describing, in his words, a picture of a misshapen nude woman, repellent from every standpoint. The show changed American art for the next several generations, right up to now. Thanks to the activist artists who made the show happen, the art gained traction. Much of it was purchased by American collectors, and abstraction and modernism could break the hold of the academic tradition, which they certainly did. But artists and creators had been presenting these challenges for a while. To look for a new approach to a visual structure, you could walk over to the Eiffel Tower, for example, which had already knocked people for a loop in 1889.
It's just that I would like to go up in it to see what it looks like from the inside.
If you were in Paris in the late 1880s, you were for it or you were against it. It was what is now seen as an early modernist masterpiece, that tall tower built by Gustave Eiffel out of around 18,000 pre-constructed interchangeable parts. It had been built as a temporary thing to dress up the Universal Exhibition.
You have to see an iconic structure which is much talked about. So we don't mind waiting the 2 hours probably today because only the one lift is working.
The line to climb the Eiffel Tower snakes around and packs the plaza in front of the tower pretty much every day.
Probably it's a wonder of the world, so we just want to see what it looks like.
People pouring in and out of the lift to the top. Eager to see the Paris rooftops from the tower's height of about 81 stories.
The first one is the restaurant, same exhibition shops. La visite à la première plante, la visite à l'étage.
You could not escape the tower, wrote the late Robert Hughes in his book The Shock of the New. It was and is the one structure that can be seen from every point in the city. The tower became the symbol of Paris overnight, and in doing so, it proclaimed La Ville Lumière, the City of Lights, to be the modernist capital. Anne Temkin of the Museum of Modern Art says the tower, then the tallest man-made structure in the world, was a catalyst for all kinds of debates and emotions about modernity.
Do you know that over 30 million people went to Paris that summer in 1889 to see this Universal Exhibition? I mean, imagine in the 19th century, 30 million people getting themselves to Paris. I think it was 200 acres of Paris were overtaken with special exhibitions about modern technology, modern design, of course, modern art.
The Eiffel Tower remained the tallest structure in the world until 1930, when it was supplanted by the Chrysler Building. You can imagine how invigorating it must have been to see a display of such scope and currency, and how terrifying. It makes you understand that not every artist could embrace the present in that period and into the future. There were other ways to respond to change and the growth of cities and technology that had overtaken the culture.
So you think of somebody like Van Gogh going down to the south of France. I mean, if you look at Van Gogh's paintings, you would have no idea there were trains and steam engines and factories and so on. And that wasn't far enough for Gauguin. He had to take himself to Tahiti. I think the greatest example of this is the Monet water lilies paintings that Monet painted in his garden for 20 years throughout the teens and the 20s. You know, this absolutely natural paradise-like subject in the middle of all this change. And at the same time that Monet was off in his garden, yes, you had the futurists painting trains and cars and machines and scenes of war and many other artists as well, thrusting that new environment into their work.
More on the futurists later. Meanwhile, back at the Eiffel Tower, do visitors know its history? When it was built? That it was created not by an artist or an architect, but by an engineer? At the time it was introduced to Paris, pre-Wright brothers, only a handful of builders and climbers had ever been up that high. It provided a new vantage point from which to observe the world. Here on the ground, still waiting in line, a group of 18 from India.
We know it was made for exhibition at some point of time to be demolished after the exhibition, but somehow people liked it. And in the beginning, there was a reaction, I think, that it's not so good. And then once you see the thing, you probably like it. So then you just stayed around.
It's true. There were massive protests from artists and non-artists alike who feared the tower would be a hideous blight on the beautiful city of Paris. Even after it was built, they protested. Popular writer Guy de Maupassant famously ate lunch at the base of the tower every day. He said it was the only place in Paris he could have lunch where he didn't have to look at the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, it looked ugly to people in the beginning. And once you start looking at the same thing, you probably start liking it, I think.
It looks ugly at the beginning, but then you look at it, and you look at it, and you start to like it. The story of culture shock, the story of modernism in a nutshell.
So much of modernism, whether you're listening to it or reading it or seeing it, initially is ugly. Because I think one way of defining beauty in a funny way is the familiar. What's beautiful to you is what you recognize, what you know. And what's ugly is what you can't fit into your expectation of what something should look like or sound like. And so invariably throughout the course of this 100-year period, whether we're talking about paintings by Matisse or various concerts, various books, the critics' initial reaction, let alone the general public's was this is absolute baloney.
Which brings us back to Marcel Duchamp. By any critic's standards, one of history's most brilliant and persuasive baloney makers. Duchamp, having rocked the art world with his cubist futurist painting of a well-concealed descending nude, pretty much gave up painting altogether in favor of something he called a ready-made.
Ready-made. I coined that word for ready-made objects, which I designated as works of art by simply signing them.
The artist talked about it later in an interview.
The first one was in 1913. It was a bicycle wheel, an ordinary wheel, a bicycle wheel, on a stand. I would turn it as I passed by. The movement of it would be like a fire in a fireplace. You know, it has that attraction of something moving in the room while you think about something else.
They, the ready-mades, were an entirely new idea of what art could be. Things, objects. You could buy them, sign them, and put them on a pedestal, like a piece of sculpture. Money was not the issue, and neither was artistry, as it had been understood up to that moment.
Then the second one was a bottle dryer. You know, they have in cellars, in the French cellars. And then the third one was a snow shovel, which I bought at in a hardware shop. And it's now, one replica of it is in Yale.
The most famous ready-made was a porcelain urinal called fountain.
A word that's very in fashion at this moment, a kind of made-up word, is de-skilling, de-skilling.
And Temkin.
So it's artists who make work, obviously, de-emphasizing skill and emphasizing something else, emphasizing, in fact, a kind of ostentatious lack of skill. So that's a very 2012 usage, and it goes back particularly to this moment in 1912-13.
It goes back to Duchamp, really, one of the earliest de-skillers, you could say.
For Duchamp, if what doesn't matter is how well you can draw a line or how beautifully you can mix oil paints, which basically anybody can learn to do, his point, which has had umpteen kinds of spin-offs in the time since, is what counts is the statement. And if it actually took no skill at all, who cares?
That's a hard thing to understand right now, let alone in 1913. And throughout the years following, Duchamp's mind was on fire.
I call it a reciprocal ready-made. You take a painting by Rembrandt, and instead of looking at it, you use it plainly as an ironing board. You iron your clothes on it. So it becomes a ready-made and reciprocal.
You're rather hard on the Rembrandt.
It is. But we had to be iconoclastic then.
Duchamp thought adventurously in sound, too. This is a composition of his from our year, 1913. You're listening to WNYC's Culture Shock 1913. I'm Sarah Fischko. Coming up, Sigmund Freud complicates the picture, and Arnold Schoenberg sparks a riot. Back in a minute. I'm Sarah Fischko. This is WNYC's Culture Shock 1913, looking at that landmark cultural year and the many things leading up to its calendar of unsettling events. So you have to ask, what had happened to the culture to allow and encourage these powerful art excursions into new territory. What was going on? You could say European culture in general was in a state of shock.
I think it was a shock.
Philip Blom, whose book about pre-World War I Europe is called The Vertigo Years, maintains this era threw people off balance. It was exhilarating but also dizzying to witness so much dramatic change so fast.
The realities on the ground had become completely different. Where there had been a city of 100,000, there was now a city of 2 million. Where your parents had worked in a rhythm that was dictated by weeks, you were now in a rhythm that was dictated by minutes because you had to clock in and the telephone rang and things like that.
Nothing traditional really makes sense anymore and satisfies anymore.
Frederick Morton wrote Thunder at Twilight about 1913 and 14 in Vienna.
There is something other that is real. So Picasso's Cubism and the Italian Futurism and later on the Soviet-Russian Constructivism, they were all related, not the things that we have seen until now and that we have seen on canvases or that we heard in concert halls. It does not respond to our real needs.
There were complicated needs brought about by even more complicated internal revelations.
Think of Freud, who said that your sexual impulses that are repressed, because you have to be a decent person, you can't be seen to covet someone, you can't be behaving in a way that is not acceptable to society, well, that's actually bad for you. And you should learn to get in touch with those urges, and you should accept the fact that children have sexual thoughts. These were frightening things. These were terrible things at the time. I think they are still frightening and rather terrible to some people today.
And even this science, which was introducing those terrifying ideas for the first time, had its own factions and uncertainties right at that moment. The Austrian neurologist Sigmund Freud and the Swiss psychologist Carl Jung had been excitedly corresponding and comparing notes on practices, problems, and dreams.
Jung was very interested in dreams. He was very interested in his own dreams.
Later, Jungian analyst Diane Fremont notes, Freud and Jung traveled together.
And on this trip to America, they were analyzing each other's dreams and disagreeing about how to analyze them.
That was in 1909. By 1913, they found themselves in the same room at the same time at the 4th International Psychoanalytic Conference. It was September of 1913.
Oh, of course. I mean, that was the time of the great civil war within psychoanalysis. Jung really, for the first time, came out against Freud. That Psychoanalytic Congress in Munich really produced a showdown between the two.
I couldn't agree with quite a number of his ideas.
Carl Jung was interviewed about Freud many years later.
Well, chiefly his purely personal approach and his disregard of the historical conditions of man.
There's no question that the presence of two ambitious thinkers studying and writing and attending conferences and arguing about the unconscious mind and dreams and sexual impulses had a profound effect. The thinking of both of them was radical.
Up until around 1850, the sort of dominant view was the view of the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, which in its extreme form thought of human beings as being very specially created by God to be rational creatures and to be guided by deep insight.
Neuroscientist and Nobel laureate Dr. Eric Kandel says this long-held view was challenged by modernism.
Modernists were influenced by Darwin, who argued that human beings were not specially created but evolved from simple animal ancestors. And there was very good evidence through the work of Freud that human beings were not completely rational, but driven importantly by unconscious instincts, as Darwin had suggested and as Freud elaborated.
This radical rethinking that had come about at the end of the 19th century and the earliest years of the 20th was now building, and it was reflected in the art.
Many artists and writers were reading Freud and Jung and reading psychological work, so there was an inter-fermentation, I think, certainly in the culture at that time. And there was much less delineation between art, writing, literature, psychology. Jung had these conferences yearly where scientists, artists, writers, everyone would come together and talk about ideas.
There were coffee houses that had very important social roles where people of different disciplines met, and people were less afraid of artists speaking with scientists and vice versa.
Just around this time, composer Arnold Schoenberg wrote to his friend, the painter Kandinsky, "Art," he said, "belongs to the unconscious." On to Vienna, where a Schoenberg scandal was about to erupt.
First of all, I'd like to welcome all of you here to the music, and thank you very much for visiting our house. We are standing right in the middle of the so-called music front already, because normally...
I'm with a group taking the tour of Vienna's greatest, most historic concert hall, the Musikverein. They're doing a little construction here, but you can still see the massive amounts of gold leaf and feel the great history of the place. Johannes Brahms was the director here in the 19th century. Every great international concert artist has performed here. In fact, this is the place where, every New Year's Eve for the last century and more, Viennese waltzes have rung out the old and rung in the new. But Magdalena Manhara, our tour guide, says people still talk about what happened in this very spot in March of 1913.
The most famous incident is the, we call it Watschen concert. Watschen means, in English means, if you slap somebody's face. It happened in 1913 when the Vienna Philharmonic...
The slap in the face was mutual. The audience felt slapped in the face by the music. The conductor, Arnold Schoenberg, was almost slapped in the face by the audience. Not long after he got on stage to conduct a performance of music of his own, as well as pieces by his colleagues, Berg and Webern. After a short time, there were protests in this bastion of respectable classical music. Music critic Alex Ross.
It had to be stopped. The uproar was too extreme. Fights had broken out. The police were called because it really had dissolved completely into chaos.
And the Golden Hall of the Musikverein was cleared of all audience members by a combination of police, firefighters, and other officials who sensed a riot in the making. Schoenberg was almost lynched, people climbing on stage, supporters and opponents of the music arguing aggressively.
It was the most famous scandal of the beginning of the 20th century. It filled newspapers.
Tourists may chuckle about it now, but in 1913, it was very serious business. But as dramatic as it sounds, it had been building up to this point for a while. What Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern were doing, the music that provoked what is now known as the Skandalkonzert of 1913, was an extension of a breaking apart of tradition that had started a while back.
Especially in the decade of the 1880s,
audiences were already starting to feel a certain unease about some departures from tradition, particular chords and musical combinations.
That was the period when Liszt was writing his final works. Debussy was beginning to explore these new areas of harmony.
And they floated around tonality in a new way, says pianist Jeremy Denk.
Until the harmony is floating completely away. You would never do in that music. That's the antithesis of that music is to resolve it. It's about something else.
But it was really not until the very beginning of the 20th century that audiences began to perceive this new harmonic language and began to take fright at it, in a sense.
Schoenberg and his colleagues were using a free atonal style, which later evolved into his famous 12-tone system, in which, as he said, the notes were related only to each other rather than to a particular key. In 1913, his radical Piero Lunaire was heard in Berlin. His massive cantata, Gurlieder, was heard in Vienna. And then this Skandalkonzert, in which public sentiment was so supercharged and so anti-Schoenberg, the concert was stopped in the first half hour.
I think part of it is actually that Schoenberg has a complete language
in these works.
Composer and Schoenberg biographer Alan Shawn.
The coherence, the density, the quality of it makes it kind of monolithic. If you don't enter it, you don't enter it, you know.
The abandonment of conventional musical rules was a shock even for the people writing the music. They had left tonality and couldn't turn back. And especially Anton Webern felt it acutely.
Webern uses the word panic about that moment in their work when they realized that it no longer actually was true to the piece to pretend that it had been tonal. To simply display a tonal coat of arms, to use Schoenberg's phrase, at the end of a piece when it hasn't been tonal at any other point felt dishonest and ridiculous.
Like an artificial facade, perhaps.
There seems to have been a great preoccupation with facades and what's behind them.
Philip Blom, author of The Vertigo Years.
So already you had a feeling of a disjunction between what was shown and what was actually happening behind that. And you see that very strongly in the writings of Sigmund Freud, for instance, who of course writes about that, who says the bourgeois facades that we have to put on, they may actually be bad for us. And anyway, they don't represent what's really going on inside us. And that is something that you see very strongly in the art of that time, that people try to look behind the facade of a tradition at what is really functioning, how things really work. And you can think of Schoenberg in that context and think, well, he really wanted to break down music to its constituents' elements. But you also see the early architecture that does that. You say, let's get rid of this facade. Let's just expose the functional elements of a building. You see that in painting where, as it were, the paintings are stripped down right to the bare minimum.
After the Skandal concert of March 1913, Arnold Schoenberg stood firm, says cellist Fred Sherry.
Schoenberg, of all the composers, never retraced his steps. As soon as he wrote a piece, the next piece was already evolving and already taking place.
It's a real question. Where does an artist get the courage to go out on a limb? For Schoenberg, there were many factors. Alex Ross believes.
You have the musical pressure toward innovation, toward experimentation, Schoenberg's sense of wanting to catch up with the painters and poets around him, that's certainly one factor. The sense of being a young Jewish man in Vienna at a time when anti-Semitism was on the rise, but it was certainly not a cold and calculated act, nor was he any kind of provocateur. He was an incredibly serious man, a man deeply devoted to classical tradition.
But a man committed to the new, his way into the new.
I would say he is the most radical thinker of this entire period. And there's no doubt in my mind, you know, of the two great riots that occurred in the year 1913, the Schoenberg riot in Vienna, March 31st, was the more severe, the more serious, the more violent. That was a real break. That was a real confrontation between a composer and the audience, many of whom very strongly rejected what he was proposing.
These confrontations do happen in this year, all over. Coming up, fulminating futurists, shattered syntax, and the riot over the Rite of Spring. Back in a minute. I'm Sarah Fishko, and you're listening to WNYC's Culture Shock 1913. exploring the astonishing explosion of then-shocking modernist ideas and creative works in that early 20th century period.
So you have to look at what happened in 1913 in a generational manner. People born all around the same time came of age confronting a set of common problems.
Conductor and educator Leon Botstein.
The same way we talk about, you know, we read in the paper all the time about how our life is going to change because there's Facebook and there's the internet and the cell phone. These people did it all the time. There was electric light, there was the automobile, there was, you know, much more than a cell phone. And people were, the elevator, and people were telling them that, you know, forget what you know, it's going to be irrelevant.
Forget what you know. That was certainly how the Italian futurists looked at it. Luigi Russolo created the art of noise. Silence, he said, was a 19th century thing.
He developed these intonarumori, or noise intoners.
NYU Italian studies professor Ada Mergen.
In order to experiment with various sounds, many of which were drawn from the urban environment.
Russolo and his compatriots were eager to bury the past, burn the old paintings, shatter the quiet of the past century. Many miles away, Russian futurism was alive as well. Vladimir Klebnikov, futurist poet, wrote, "We rang for room service, and the year 1913 answered. It gave planet Earth a valiant new race of people, the heroic Futurians." Russian painter Kazimir Malevich painted the first black square painting in 1913. Just that, a black square on a white background. He was the founder of the abstract art movement known as suprematism.
Within all of these isms, the individual artists have very distinct voices.
Museum of Modern Art curator Anne Temkin.
However, one thing that I think was important to all of these artists was that the value was placed on being new. And this is an absolute contradiction to what the 19th century academic tradition would have been, which is to do what the people before you were doing perfectly, or even better.
Just to excel in what you were taught and conform to what you were taught had been enough before this.
And instead, with modernism, the idea was absolutely toss away what it is one would have been taught in school and invent something that nobody in the world had thought up before you thought it up.
What is the use of a violent kind of delightfulness if there is no pleasure in not getting tired of it? The question does not come before there is a quotation. In any kind of place, there
Joyce was working on Ulysses. Kafka, Proust, and Pound were working on soon-to-be-celebrated works. And Gertrude Stein's Tender Buttons, just written in 1912, was about to be published. And the fragments that were finding their way into paintings and music were affecting structure and sound and syntax.
And wear it and then be reckless and resolved on returning gratitude.
In Tender Buttons, Stein's words shatter structure.
Any neglect of many particles to a cracking, any neglect of this makes around it what is lead in color and certainly discolor in silver.
So in this poem, she really invents wordness.
Poet and teacher Charles Bernstein.
You feel the words themselves stripped of or liberated from their burden of representation or the necessity for them to function as representation. So what would it be like for language to convey just its own verbalness, its wordness?
Altogether made a dress. And suppose it was actual. Suppose the mean way to state it was occasional. If you suppose this in August, and even more melodiously, if you suppose this in even the necessary...
Stein continued along these lines for decades, and it still sounded new much later. As in, If I Told Him, a completed portrait of Picasso, which Stein herself recorded in the 30s.
And as he. He is, and as he is.
They were the same familiar individual words, combined and manipulated so as to catch the ear in a completely new way. Which leads us to The Rite of Spring. The most famous bassoon solo in the history of music. Even just that, played in the extreme high register of an instrument known best for its lowness, was enough to send chills up the spines of the privileged audience, hearing its legendary first performance in Paris that spring of 1913. The famous first night of the Ballet Russe production of The Rite of Spring is probably the best-known cultural reset, the best-known one-night revolution ever. Its kind of before and after status has put it in a special touchstone category.
The most famous event in all of 1913 artistic history, which
Leon Botstein, who's been giving lectures lately about the score and the scandal,
of The Rite of Spring,
says it's hard to remember a time when art made a difference, which on that night it certainly did.
And that people were actually scandalized by what they considered to be an offensive artistic pretense. So it's fascinating to look back at a time where people got upset about what music was being written. And the response wasn't either to ignore it or just to shut it off.
They couldn't shut it off on May 29th, 1913, at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées in Paris. Not the music by Stravinsky, not the costumes and scenic design by Nicholas Roerich, not the choreography by Vaclav Nijinsky, says New Yorker writer and author Joan Acacella.
It could not have been more anti-balletic, more different from ballet if it had tried.
Ballet in the late 19th century was fluid and beautiful. It was defined by a soft, curving style.
You can think of the music in that way, but also ballet with the beautifully curved arms, the beautifully separated fingers. All of this is rounded, gradual, sweet, lyrical. It looks like, well, I mean, in the crudest case, it looks like something that would be on the cover of a card, a greeting card.
In The Rite of Spring, the dancing and the music were perfect examples of that moment's interest in what was then called primitivism.
It involved bent knees, feet either straight forward or turned in, pigeon-toed, shuffling, jumping on flat feet. Well, nobody had ever seen anything like it before.
Empty stage. That doesn't happen very often.
Looking around inside the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, where it all happened,
so this is the hall,
is like walking on hallowed ground, knowing that the flat feet, bent knees, and audience apoplexy played out right here.
And you don't have a single straight line. Everything is round and curved.
Michel Franck is the director of the theater now, and he lives with this history.
In one day, the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées went world famous. That was a kind of, you know, turning point. Everything was different after Rite of Spring.
The theater itself had just opened in April of that year, and even the place itself had generated controversy. A far cry from the highly decorated Garnier Opera. It had simple lines, nothing ornate about it. Built of concrete, with large areas encased in French white marble. And it was and is on the ritziest street in the western part of Paris.
We are located on the Avenue Montaigne, where you've got all the luxury brands are located here, as Dior and Vuitton and Chanel. So it was already like this at the beginning of the century, the rich part of Paris, near the Champs-Élysées. The audience was already of the upper class, definitely.
Not that they felt especially compelled to behave in an elegant fashion at the theater that night. The shocking premiere has been dramatized in several movies, including the pretty trashy Herbert Ross biopic, Nijinsky.
We are told that poor Nijinsky stood in the wings, screaming the counts to the dancers, because the noise in the theater was so loud that the dancers could not hear the orchestra. That is the story.
Let the performance continue!
So how to understand an audience making this scene?
There's a continuing controversy about what the riot was really over, the music or the choreography.
Joan Acacella says Stravinsky wrote in an early memoir that he thought it was about the choreography. Of course.
He said that Nijinsky was ignorant of music, the choreography was bad, and that this is what the riot was over. Many people feel, on the contrary, that what sparked the riot was really the music. And then the kind of primitive stuff, um bum 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 bum.
This rhythm, this pulsing rhythm,
you know, people, I think, you know, their jaws dropped over this.
And the accents keep landing in different places.
Author and critic Alex Ross.
Well, we now think of it as this enormous vitality, but at the time I think it must have seemed like this really alien force bearing down on the audience, and they rebelled.
And then there was the response to the dissenters who were making so much noise.
Protesting, mumbling, muttering, whistling. The enthusiasts struck back very loudly, very violently. After a certain point, people couldn't even have been listening to the music.
From the diaries of Count Harry Kessler, Paris, May 29, 1913. In the evening, the premiere of The Rite of Spring, a thoroughly new vision, something never before seen, he writes, enthralling, persuasive, a new kind of wildness, both un-art and art at the same time. The public, the most elegant house I have ever seen in Paris, was from the beginning restless, laughing, whistling, making jokes. Here and there, some stood up. Kessler goes on to describe quarreling in the loge between the composer Debussy and the Italian writer and nationalist D'Annunzio. As arguments and loud clapping and stomping broke out, the dancers, he wrote, without flinching, danced fervently in a prehistoric fashion. That eyewitness account tells us something about what this particular museum director, patron, and patriot thought at the time. And we know that some of the people responsible for the production were not all that upset.
Certainly Diaghilev, the promoter, was thrilled. I mean, scandal is good. I wish for scandal. I wish desperately that every concert I give would anger somebody.
Conductor Leon Botstein.
Outrage someone.
Stravinsky tried on a lot of different hats over the years.
Writer and USC professor Tim Page.
But I don't think he ever got quite as completely radical and shocking as he did with Rite of Spring.
And audiences love it because it's a sensual thrill. It makes a racket. It is absolutely riveting to listen to. Because he was writing movie music before there were movies. There was a scenario.
Even the composer himself wasn't sure exactly where the score came from.
And you can really believe Stravinsky when he said he was just sitting there and this music just seemed to visit him. It seemed to come through him from some unknown source. It's just extraordinary to think about him sitting there creating this piece bar by bar.
I got a chance to see a copy of the manuscript of The Rite of Spring.
Cellist Fred Sherry.
And you can see how fast Stravinsky wrote that, because it's like you see in some Bach manuscripts that the way he wrote is on a slant. Like, he couldn't write faster. He's just writing, and this is a slant because the music is facing forward, even, you know, on the page. And after it was done, he never stopped tinkering with it. Every time he'll say, oh, he'd come to conduct the Rite of Spring, he said, oh, that timpani note, could you put it here? There must have been things that he heard, like, why didn't I do that? And the answer is, he wrote it too fast to even be able to think about some of the niceties of editing.
Although everyone agrees that one of its contributions is editing, the way it brazenly moves from one section to the next. This is a piece of music that simply cuts to where it wants to be. and hang the transitions. It is pretty shocking. As for that riotous first night, you have to figure the Parisians' affection for scandal must have played a role, too. Because after giving 6 performances of The Rite in Paris, the Ballet Russe moved on and went to the Drury Lane Theatre in London, where the British audience gave the ballet a measured reception with polite applause. And the fact is, after the initial shock, people fell in love with the music, even the French. Later, Disney used it. Film composers copied it. You can find it hidden in plain sight in any number of the most beloved movie scores, including Godfather II. But it is revered still. The Eiffel Tower principle applies once again. People thought it was ugly, then they kept hearing it. And then, after a while, they admired it. This is a cultural moment full of that kind of shock. And, of course, the next chapter of the story would take us to World War I. In fact, 1913 is of even greater interest because it came just before 1914 and that most earth-shaking and world-changing event. The French poet Charles Péguy didn't even know it was coming. When he said in our year 1913, and I quote, "The world has changed less since the time of Jesus Christ than it has in the last 30 years."
It's interesting to me to hear that quote because I think I hear people say that so much today about even the last decade, that what has happened essentially digitally has so completely transformed our world. And certainly one of the things that modernism, with a capital M, has in common with whatever we are today is that underlying anxiety.
Today there is a multitude of power centers and possibilities and social visions and market economic ideas, and we don't know who or what will win. That was very much something that I think people before the First World War also felt. They felt there were all these forces swirling around, and they didn't know which one would really dominate and which one would be sucked under again. And then, of course, there's the historical change that we've had to come to terms with, a complete change in our societies, in their social structure. All that has happened in the last 4 or 5 generations, and we still have so much to digest from the century that preceded us.
So maybe this is our time to process the last decades and the last century. It could be we're about to experience the next great cultural explosion, when artists, as they did a century ago, help us sort it out, with sometimes shocking results. You've been listening to Culture Shock 1913, which was produced at WNYC. Associate producer was Laura Mayer. Editor was Karen Frillman. Mix engineer was Wayne Schulmeister, with additional mixing by Edward Haber. Our intern was Carla Green. We had invaluable help from Frederic Castel and Evan Spritzer in Paris, and Kerry Skyring in Vienna. Gertrude Stein readings were by Karen Ludwig. Special thanks to WNYC colleagues Dean Capello, Chris Bennett, and Kathleen Ehrlich. I'm Sarah Fischko.
When you set out to challenge all the established values, your means was shock. You shocked the cubists, you shocked the public, you shocked the buying public.
Yes.
Do you think the public can be shocked anymore by anything it sees?
Finish. That's over. You cannot shock the public.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.